Good evening, and welcome again to another edition of Music from the Global Village. This is show number 99 in the series. And this evening we have a special program in mind, dealing with the many ranges of the musician, artist, and visionary Brian Eno. And I have some help tonight from a good friend of mine by the name of Tarl. A few brief biographical notes on Brian Eno. He was born in 1948. Born Brian Peter George St. John Le Baptiste de La Salle Eno. The 15th of May in Woodbridge, Suffolk, England. And his education was basically normal and got involved with the aesthetics and the arts, and thereby went to art school from 64 to 66 at Ipswich Art School Foundation, and from 66 to 69 furthered his studies at the Winchester Art School Diploma in Fine Art. From there he went on to his own studies, dealing with his own conceptual ideas. And from his earliest days at art college, Eno was interested in thinking and talking about his work as he was producing it. So much was the case that tutors who doubted his natural ability as a painter assumed that he would find his niche as a theorist or a teacher. In the event, like many most gifted creative personalities in the fields of art, music, and literature, Eno became both artist and thinker. In Eno's work, theory and practice are twin components, individually linked, of the same creative intelligence. More than any other rock musician of the early 1970s, Eno was driven by the urge to explain and justify the paths he had taken. From the beginning, Eno regarded the press interview as a useful platform, a chance to articulate his ideas about music, art, cybernetics, and society. This impulse to explain his ideas and work led Eno to undertake lecture tours of universities and to write articles. By the end of the 1970s, Eno had established himself, in the words of one U.S. magazine, as the prime theoretician of rock and roll and beyond. So enjoy a conceptual idea of the mind of Brian Eno as we pay special tribute to his work entire, as much as can be put in a 3-hour format. We begin tonight with his first landmark piece in the ambient range, ambient number 1, Music for Airports. And if you'd like to call tonight, as any other night, the number here is 768-8777.
The problem with doing interviews and so on is that it gives the impression that you always think about yourself. And I don't, that's the kind of thing I don't think about very much. I don't know. Well, what I mean is I'm so unclear about what I'm doing myself that it's very hard to work out what it means for anyone else as well. I think of myself more and more as a sound painter, if you like, and I work in much the same way as a painter does. I tend to work alone, and I tend to work in a painterly way, which is that I put things on, take them off again, mix things up together in different ways. Furthermore, I usually go into the studio without a strong conception of what I shall come out with. I sometimes have even only the vaguest idea. At the moment, there isn't much I can do on stage. I'm not a brilliant player of any instrument. I'm not a great singer or anything like that, and I don't see myself as a personality type figure in music. So my inclination is to work where I can, which is in the studio. Although, of course, there's quite a lot of pressure for me to perform. But at the moment, I don't see what I would gain by performing. I don't think it would make any difference to the music to do that. Though that's changing in my mind. I'm now starting to think about performing. I tend not to want to use music as a vehicle for my own passions in the way that, well, the kind of rhythm and blues tradition looks that way, though I don't think it necessarily is. But I tend to want to keep myself out of the music to an extent. And certainly with works like discrete music and music for airports, they're very impersonal. Well, I think they are, but then again, when I listen to them, I think, well, who else would do a record like that? And so in a sense, they're still my music, but they don't pretend to transmit some emotion that is in me and which I then put in the work for other people to pick up on. That's what it is, I think. I don't use it as a transmitter in that sense. I'm not a passionate person, in at least musically. Well, I guess I like the same things as a lot of other people, really, in music. That's what it is. My musical tastes aren't bizarre and esoteric, though I do like some esoteric things as well. But actually, the music that has affected me and the music that I loved when I grew up was the same as what everyone else loved, I think, or enough other people loved. I would think that it's certain that there would be a common ground in our tastes. And since most of the decisions in my work are on the basis of do I like it or don't I like it, rather than some more complicated construction, most of the final decisions are on that basis. Do I like it? If I like it, then I release it. If I don't, then it just stays as another experiment that didn't come out. I think one of the great failures of the fine art scene, for example, the painting scene, is that it's created a situation where artists can't move very easily. I mean, that an artist, once he's defined the style and become popular for it, unless he's very, very successful, is really constrained to stay within that, you know. And it's a platitude to say it, but it really is true that an artist has his trademark, so that you can look at it and you say, oh yes, that's a Rothko, or that's a Larry Poons or whatever, because you know Rothko always has those blurry shapes and Larry Poons always has those dots. Now, I'm not against the idea of exploring one format in depth like that, but I am against the idea of having to explore one format in depth. My interest has always been in working with novelty of some kind or another. I either work with novel instruments or with novel approaches to working, or with some kind of novelty is the input. When I've exhausted the energy that one gets from novelty, I generally move on. Now, I can see that that's also can be seen as a shallow way of working, but actually I don't move on and abandon those things. They do get reincorporated. For instance, I think you can see a coming together over the last few years between my songs and my discrete music orientation, which started off looking very separate, but they seem to be moving a bit closer together. But I don't force it. I'm not actually out to make a liaison between all these types of music. I don't mind if they're separate, and I don't mind if they come together. The great strength of dilettantism is that it tends to come in from another angle. It doesn't always, of course. The other way of being a dilettante is just by doing the most pedantic and obvious things. But an intelligent dilettante will not be constrained by the limitations of what's normally considered possible. He won't be frightened. He's got nothing to lose. You know, a person who has his career at stake on every piece of work is obviously going to be a bit more defensive about what he does. Whereas the dilettante who just kind of says, oh, I'll try this for a while, he's not so frightened of failure, I would imagine. But to maintain a dilettante attitude consciously is also rather suspicious. I guess I've passed the dilettante phase now. I've decided that I am a musician and or a composer, and that's what I do. So, and I can't generally pretend to be naive anymore, though I'm still musically naive in a sense. I have to take a different approach now to what I'm doing. In popular arts, the question of tradition is very interesting because most popular work is about 94% tradition, about 6% innovation. And that seems to me like a good kind of ratio as well. I believe that the function of culture that is always overlooked by people who are into the avant-garde and experimental music is not only to innovate, but to keep rehearsing and rehashing what exists already. And rock music is a great example of this. You know, there's always things are being recalled and built back into the structure again. And of course, what you choose to ignore and what you choose to re-enhance, what you choose to use again, is just as important a statement as the innovations you make. Before and after science means those two positions, the futuristic, which I would call post-science, and the primitive, pre-science. My feeling also is that the last 200 or 300 years in the West are quite unique historically and culturally, and they're not like any other period in human history that we know of in any other culture. And they seem to be almost an aberration of some kind. Now, that doesn't mean that isn't a value judgment about them. But I think that the post-science condition will bear far more similarities with the pre-science one than the science position in the middle. Because this is what I guess gives rise to all of the technological primitivism that one sees now.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.